nine times out of 10, when someone is taking the time to break away and do their own thing, it's because they either have a specific point of view or a specific passion that really sort of speaks to maybe not a mass audience, but the customers that I have and the customers that Barterhouse tries to culture and cultivate, I think are those type of people who want that story and feel like if they take an allocation of an 80 case made wine, that they've got something special and it's something that only they have or maybe one other person has. So that's kind of what we specialize in. And, you know, it may not be business savvy to the nth degree, like we're not making 100,000 cases of Pinot Grigio and, you know, flogging them all over New York, but the customers that get wine from us are kind of believing the same stuff we do, which is supporting these small farms, supporting these young winemakers who have a passion for doing it. And we supply them with a market and we allow them to get their product out there to otherwise an untapped group of people.
Hey there, welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm Linda Palacio, your host here on Heritage Radio Network. And today, as the people in the East Coast, in particular us New Yorkers, trudge out from under a very heavy blanket of snow. Heavy blanket, 19 inches. Come on. Where are the ski lifts and the ski slopes? This is New York City, for goodness sake. We don't need 19 inches of snow. But what a great day to reach out to talk about the food of a sunnier, warmer climate. And not only that, but go to the West Coast where we can find someone who can talk about it who's not stuck in a snowdrift. We're going to talk today about Moroccan food, the food of the Mediterranean, really. I mean, the Mediterranean diet, as we all know, has been touted for many years as being such a healthy diet. And it really does have quite a rich legacy. And I have found just the person to talk to us about that. And that is Kitty Morse. Kitty is she was born in Casablanca in Morocco of French and British parentage. And she has had a nice long career as a food writer and a cooking teacher, a gourmet tour organizer specializing in Morocco and North Africa. And that career spans more than 25 years. She's been a guest on Food TV, CNN, Discovery, and she's contributed to all the food magazines that we know of, the Bon Appetit and Cooking Light. And she's written quite a few cookbooks, among them Cooking at the Kasbah, The Vegetarian Table, North Africa, and other single subject books like Couscous, Preserved Lemons, Edible Flowers. But the one that jumped out at me from a culinary historian's view is her recent re-edition, actually, called A Biblical Feast, Ancient Mediterranean Flavors for Today's Table. In that book, Kitty explains food's culinary, historical, and spiritual links. And I really like what the Austin Chronicle had to say about it. They wrote, "A Biblical Feast is more than a standard how-to book, part history lesson, part cookbook. It weaves together stories from the Bible with exhaustive definitions, explanations, and directions not only on how to cook, but also on how to understand the food people ate at that time. A biblical feast reminds us that the Bible is not just a holy text, it's also an ethnic historical text that gives modern readers a window into the past." And certainly, art historians and archaeologists have used the Bible as history for many years in their studies. And Kitty found this as a special way and a special link to learn more about the food of her land. And I'm welcome to have her with me today. Hello, Kitty.
Hi, Linda. Thank you for this lovely introduction.
It's a wonderful thing to be able to talk about the sunny, warm foods of the Mediterranean today, let me tell you that. And I was really interested to know that you talked a lot about food and drink and communal meals being so essential to physical life that the authors of the scripture actually included them, as we know, as parables and allegories. And what I mean, what got you inspired to use this as research for the food?
Well, as I explained in my introduction, I was, and as you mentioned, I was born in Casablanca, and I was attending our little Anglican church. It's a lovely little Anglican church, smack dab in the middle of Casablanca, if you can believe that. And I was listening to an Easter sermon, and it suddenly struck me that what I was hearing in as the in church was so similar to what I knew outside the church walls, mainly that biblical foods were probably, first of all, it's a Mediterranean cuisine, so we, in biblical times, they relied a lot on olives and figs and dates and pomegranates and cumin and saffron and all these ingredients that are essential to Moroccan cuisine, as well as possibly eating in the same manner, because when we think of Leonardo da Vinci's table, which was lined in a nice starched white tablecloth,
and
the Last Supper, exactly, and all the disciples sitting upright behind the table, it struck me that I don't think so in the Middle East and in North Africa to this day, and most certainly in biblical times. They probably ate seated around a low round table, if not on the floor, seated or on a mat, and the dish placed communally in the center of the diners. And they would probably eat with their fingers, using a piece of bread, and in biblical times, leaven or unleavened flat bread, to retrieve the food from the communal dish. And so all that gelled, and I had my light bulb go off and say, oh, I think I understand this, and I think I can interpret biblical ingredients giving recipes that would be pretty close to what they ate in biblical times, because obviously in the Bible there are no recipes, except as you mentioned in Ezekiel, when we spoke Ezekiel's bread, which it's a list of ingredients, it's not recipes. And so,
which is how so many ancient texts do. They list ingredients, they never give amounts.
That's right.
Nor instructions. Right?
Nor instructions. Well, you know what? The French cookbooks of 2011 are probably much the same. They assume you know what you're doing. But in America, when you do write a cookbook, you have to be very, very, very precise. But anyway, all that sort of, gelled, and then I dived into the research, and it was so fascinating that all of a sudden I had a book.
Well, that's terrific, because it's a wonderful read, and it's a very, I think, especially for, and I don't mean to diminish the information in it, but I think it's a fabulous read for somebody, for the uninitiated to culinary history, because you really introduce foods and the lack of certain foods that people might not have a prior understanding of, and it makes it a very good read for people. And as you say in your opening, I really love that very first sentence. You said, to travel through the rural regions of my native Morocco is akin to being transported back to biblical times. And as you just stated, many of the eating habits were the same, right?
It's true, and it's true to this day, because when you travel in Morocco outside the big cities, which are
modern,
very
yes.
busy and huge and smoggy and crowded, but when you travel outside the big cities, the peasants live in much the same manner that you read about, as it's described in some biblical verses. I mean, they plow the fields with oxen, in some cases with dromedaries. They herd goats and sheep all over the place. They also subsist on a mainly vegetarian diet, grain-based diet, because meat and fish are expensive to them, as they were in biblical times. Fowl, meat, and seafood were expensive ingredients in biblical times.
Right.
And so you will find that in relation to the Mediterranean diet we think of, well, it was basically vegetarian greens, all the little pot herbs and greens of the region, and very simple. And, of course, olive oil, and more olive oil, which is what we say today, have more olive oil.
Well, and so you just answered my next question. Because, well, you mentioned in the book that the people of biblical times were really uncomplicated people, farm in terms of what they did for their living. They were farmers, they were fishermen, they were carpenters. So this diet, these products constituted their diet, right? The grains and the fruit and the herbs and the oil.
Of their little corner of the universe, you know, because they didn't travel very far. But what's different about the Mediterranean today and in biblical times is that, of course, in biblical times they had no tomatoes. You know, you think Mediterranean diets automatically in our time means tomatoes and all the citrus and the rice and, you know, all the sugar products. But actually in biblical times, they didn't have tomatoes because that's
a new
world ingredient.
Right.
They didn't have peppers, you know, chili peppers, which arrived in the Mediterranean with the conquistadors, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's not a biblical food, so I don't use tomatoes, I don't use peppers, I don't use citrus, because citrus came in later on and via Southeast Asia and then probably Alexander the Great.
Mm-hmm.
In biblical times, there was probably one citrus, the citron, the itrog citron,
right,
which grew wild and which was used in some temple ceremonies, maybe. But so some of the potatoes did not exist. And, of course, there's corn. If you read the King James Bible, it mentions corn, you know, over 100 times. Well, corn did not exist. Corn as we know it today, maize, did not exist in biblical times.
That was definitely a late New World food.
Well, it's a late New World food, but what happens in the King James Bible in particular is that corn referred to, it was a generic term for grain.
Right, or kernel. So I think what they were referring to for the corn is the kernel of the wheat.
Right.
And that
was
corn.
Right? Yes, that's right. You're right.
Right.
But in any case, it creates a lot of confusions, and because I've spoken to even, you know, priests and pastors. Oh yes, there's corn. Well, not exactly.
Yeah.
But it's easy to get confused. So
right.
There's also there's a translation little problems there that you have to single out sometimes.
That's right. That's right. There are in the book you give actually a lot of verse before each chapter or each recipe, which is nice because it gives reference and that shows your research that these foods did exist. What is a typical meal that in ancient times, let's say outside of just grain, but could you describe, let's say, a setting, what would they sit down to and eat in terms of like a dish, if you could name a dish or a not a recipe necessarily?
Sure. Well, you know, remember that in my book, as you mentioned, I really concentrate on the cuisine of the average person, the poor person, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So meat, fowl, and fish were eaten by the average person on feast days. So let's say a possible breakfast for an average family in biblical times might have consisted of milk, of bread, because of course they made their bread leavened or unleavened, and we have Ezekiel's bread, so there was leavened bread, possibly a yogurt-like cheese, and in my book I give a recipe for yogurt, you can make your own yogurt, or for a goat cheese, you can make your own goat cheese, so they certainly knew how to make that.
The first instruction is go out and buy a goat.
Well, you know what? You can buy. Actually, the recipe was tested with goat's milk from the store.
Okay.
And it works.
Good.
But you can also roll it in fresh herbs. And they had dill. You know, you could use dill. They had, since they had coriander seed, they had fresh cilantro. Coriander is the seed. So they could flavor it with crushed pepper. Peppercorns, or with salt, the main ingredient in biblical times, and they also were very fond of pickled, of pickles in brine.
Mm-hmm.
And you find that also, you know, some of the recipes are very similar to the Roman Apicius, the Roman bon vivant who wrote one of the first recipe books.
Right, Apicius or Apicius, as some people say. Yeah.
So pickle. The Romans also were very fond of pickles in brine, and maybe they had, you know, they had barley. Barley was the least expensive of the grains, so possibly barley gruel, flavored maybe with honey, of course wild honey from bee honey, maybe. So that would be, and of course, basing myself upon the Middle Eastern diet and the North African or Moroccan diet, bread dipped in olive oil. I mean, my grandfather had that every morning, a little bowl of a ramekin of olive oil, and he dipped his bread in the olive oil, and I am positive that they had that for breakfast. Well, and olives.
And olives, of course, olives.
We still do that today, you know, in Morocco. So that would be, let's say, would be a breakfast. It's a pretty good breakfast. And might have been a late, let's say this, since they went out in the field very early, they possibly had a snack very, very early in the morning. And then around 10 o'clock, they would have this kind of snack, and it would serve as a lunch.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like peasants or like farmers do today in Morocco. And then dinner, very early dinner would be the main meal of the day. And again, pickles. And again, bread, and maybe a potage. Potage meaning a stew of greens and maybe a little meat or a bone or something to flavor the broth. And then bread, of course, and then possibly yogurt, possibly fresh fruit if they were in season. So you see how it relates so much to what we eat today.
That's right. Well, we do have some recipe, if you can call them recipes. I mean, some vague idea of recipe from the cuneiform tablets, from the Babylonian or Sumerian tablets.
So,
And there are given, as you mentioned, the potage, a lot of references to these stews, where, you know, a little meat and a lot of grain. And and so, I mean, that's, you know, so that whole area, the diet was very similar, right?
It was very, very similar. And actually, you know, those stews reminded me of, again, as inspiration for the recipes, is a Moroccan tagine.
Yes,
you know, a tagine is a, for lack of a better word, an exotic Moroccan stew. I mean, right, today they're much more elaborate. But the tagine, in Moroccan terms, in farming peasant terms, is a little bit of meat, because, again, meat is expensive today in Morocco. And any seasonal vegetables that you could have that you grew, and you, it's a one-dish meal, you put it in your tagine pot. You know, it's that pot with a conical lid, which is so distinctive.
Right.
You put it on a charcoal fire, which you did in biblical times, because they cooked over charcoal. And then you forget it for the rest of the day, and then you come home and you have a wonderful stew. So I would imagine that in biblical times, some of their stews were quite similar to that.
I would imagine. Well, now you you talked about using the Bible as research, or at least your preliminary research. What other sources did you actually go to for this research?
Well, I went through decades of Archaeology Today magazine, which I found to be a wonderful resource. And I also, because I was very interested, since I had just written, previous to that, a book on California farmers, traveling up and down the state and interviewing farmers, so I was very involved in the farm scene. I was fascinated by the plants, and I found this, I didn't find it, but I came upon this book called Plants of the Bible by Dr. Harold Moldenki and his wife, which is a fabulous resource. I can't say enough good about it, because this gentleman gives you the origins and the botanical names and, you know, the Aramaic and the Greek and the Latin. So that was a great resource. And then I also talked to many experts. I mean, for example, when I was giving a recipe for a lentil stew, because lentils were very common, very inexpensive in biblical times, I called a research organization. I think it was in Syria. I believe it was in Syria. But anyway, I talked to the experts there, and do you know that there are 11,000 different varieties of lentils that have been recorded?
Wow.
So I was calling to find out, you know, can the little lentils that I buy at my supermarket, would those be okay? And, of course, I mean, they're fine. Maybe they were not exactly the variety that they found in biblical times, you know, in that area. But that's how I got sucked in. I really, really was. I was just fascinated with it.
Well, and as goes for so many foods, even New World foods like tomato, if we were to see the original tomatoes, the wild tomatoes, it would be, we would not recognize them. They're nothing, nothing to what we eat today. So that's not surprising, really, but that's really interesting. Well, you, and you referred to Dr. Moldenki in terms of giving you some kind of clue as to what is manna, because in the Bible it talks about so much that that people existed on manna. They were in the middle of the desert for all those years. How did they subsist? And it was on manna. What is manna, really?
Well,
from what you can find out.
We're not quite sure, but Moldenki and other researchers surmise that it could have been the wind-desiccated lichen. It could have been an exudate from a bush, from a tree, a hardened exudate that forms when the insect perforates the tree. It forms a little sticky sap, and that fell to the ground in the morning, and maybe that's what they gathered because it was sweet. So there's several definitions of manna, but I have to tell you that to this day, in the Middle East, and especially in Syria and Jordan, the Bedouins gather this manna from a bush. And they use it, they sell it to confectionery makers, and they also use the product to sweeten their confectionery.
Even as modern times? You don't know, but you're not sure what the bush is, what the type of bush is.
It's the Phoenix manifera, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Tamarix manifera, yeah.
Okay, because that's very interesting.
And the tree in English is called the tamarisk. So it's the wind-dispersed lichens. Maybe it could be a sort of dried algae. Maybe, and it could also be this hardened exudate. But there are others.
A meager existence, to say the least. You know.
Very meager. I mean, I think it goes. They gather this manna in maybe hundreds of pounds, and if I remember correctly, maybe 600 pounds a year. It's, you know, it's very, very rare. And, of course, the trees are in the desert, and it's sort of an expedition to go and gather the man.
Right.
It's called man.
Well, we're going to talk more about some of these interesting details and go into some of your recipes and dishes after we take a short break. So stay tuned. We are back thinking about sunny climates and foods of Morocco and the Mediterranean and talking with Kitty Morse. Kitty, certainly trade influenced the foods of that time tremendously. I mean, we know there were the Phenicians and, of course, the Spice Road had not yet occurred. It was, you know, but people were traveling and bringing exotic ingredients. And fish was a big influence from a lot of the travelers, right? Because I wanted to talk about the salt in the diet. We know from ancient Romans, of course, that they relied on liquamen or garum as their salty substance, right?
Right.
And that probably was something that that came about, you think, from a lot of these Phoenician visitors bringing the fish in. The merchants?
Well, they produced, you know, garum from biblical land, especially from Phoenicia, which is now Lebanon, was very, very famous. Now, garum is similar to the Vietnamese Noc Ma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for me, an intriguing question is, why don't we use garum in Mediterranean cuisine anymore? But they do use it in Southeast Asia, but that's my personal little question. So it was a means of preserving fish. I mean, and garum was made, or liquamen, with whatever fish they had. So it could be sardines or anchovies or whatever.
Kind of a nasty substance as it's fermenting.
Very. And, you know, funny enough, very recently I saw something on one of the, I don't know if it was a food channel or a historical channel, how they made it, where you put fish and you put water and you let it ferment for weeks on end. And
well, they would actually put it in
juice.
They'd put it in a canvas bag and then let it sit in a pot. Sometimes bury it, right?
Sometimes they did, but in Roman times and in Morocco especially, and if you go to Italy or Spain, you will see the garum vats. They created huge stone vats, and we have some at one of the Roman ruins in Morocco. Lixus, south of Tangier, was also famous. Actually, possibly the Garden of the Hesperides, but that's another question. They have the vats where they just put the fish and the water in the sun, and they let it macerate, and it made this wonderful mixture, which they exported all over the Mediterranean, and pretty soon everybody was addicted. You know, it's like us and hot sauce from Thailand.
But
they also had salt. They had mine salt. They mined it, and they also, had sea salt. They evaporated.
Right, and salt was very. That was very important to the Hebrews and in their religious ceremonies as well.
That and of course the Romans when they destroyed Carthage, they also sprinkled salt all over Carthage, so it would never spring back again. So it had also religious applications.
Uh-huh.
But the liquamen or the garum is a very intriguing product. So I do not give the recipe for how to make it, but I tell you to substitute nokmam.
It's a very good substitution because that's what it is. I mean, those fermented fish.
That's what it is.
They did
export it all over the Mediterranean. And, as we spoke about previously, I mean, they traveled extensively. The wine from Jerusalem was very famous and it was exported. The garum was exported. And then, they had it was global economy except Mediterranean size. Very interesting.
Well, you've referenced now. What I wanted to first say is that an interesting point to me. What I like about this book is, yes, you talk about the foods of the common people. And, that in culinary history, that is probably one of the most difficult things to source and research are the foods of the common people. We've got loads of documentation on banquets and royal feasts.
That's true.
But to find out what the common man ate is often a real trial. But you mentioned that the domestic cooks in the Holy Land at the time of, let's say, 30 BCE, they were primarily women.
Well, yes, because the men went into the fields.
Right.
And they also went out to hunt and fish. And as it is in the Middle East, let me refer it to North Africa because I'm talking about Middle East general terms.
Mediterranean, African
Mediterranean. Let's specifically North Africa. Yes, the men were, although the women certainly went out to help in the field, that is for sure. But usually the cooking was the domain of the women as it is today. And in Moroccan terms, recipes are transferred orally from mother to daughter through the generations. Mm-hmm. It's only until very, very recently, and I'm saying maybe 10, 15 years, that Moroccan women are writing down recipes and publishing cookbooks. So I imagine, I surmise that in biblical times it was much the same way. First of all, the women are the ones who made the bread. You know, you need the bread, and as it is in Morocco today, making bread every day takes a long time.
Yes.
It's about a two-hour proposition. You knead the bread, and then you let it rise, and then you cook it. So that was their job. Basically, in the home, providing for the men who went out to hunt and fish.
Well,
and farm.
Speaking of bread, let's talk about Ezekiel's bread. Now, this is a bread that you make, and your recipe would be using the exact same ingredients that they would have used in that time. What makes this bread different?
Well, I'm very excited about this recipe. First of all, I have seen in some markets, breads called Ezekiel's bread being sold Ezekiel's bread. However, when I checked the ingredients were not accurate in biblical terms. One of the commercial breads includes soy flour, for example, which did not exist in biblical times. So what I prided myself on is to take the ingredients, and here we have white flour, which was very expensive in biblical times, so I use it in small amounts. We have stone ground spelt. Spelt, an ancient variety of wheat. Barley flour. Barley was ground into flour, as was millet, as were lentils, fava beans, and garbanzo beans, to extend white flour, the expensive white flour. So you will find in the recipe that I give, you make your own garbanzo flour, you just crush it in your spice grinder, or you can also purchase that in Indian food stores, because that's an ingredient they use a lot in Indian cuisine.
That's right.
But anyway, these are the ingredients. Salt, which they had. And then for this particular recipe, I captured the yeast out of the air. I used natural yeast. You don't have to, but I did it in.
So you made your own sponge, your own starter.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And actually, the funny thing is I left it in the corner of my stove a bit too long, and I had this monster yeast bubbling over my stove. So I started again. But so be careful, because it really works. And then, because I'm not a baker, and I wanted to make sure that this bread was edible, I consulted with a very well-known baker here in the San Diego area, and I said, I have lentil, garbanzo, fava bean flour, millet, all these funny ingredients that have a very distinct flavor. And so we determine, you know, how much white, how much barley, how much barley flour, and the percentage of lentil, garbanzo, so the meal, so that the bread is edible. Mm-hmm. And then I garnished it. I sprinkled it with nigella seeds. Now, nigella, like cumin and like mustard seed, is one of the fitches, the small seeds of the Bible. And nigella seed, also known as love in the mist, also used a lot in North Africa for bread and in Indian cuisine. It's a tiny little black seed that has a sometimes called black cumin seed.
I was going to say, sometimes it's referred to as black cumin.
Sometimes.
But it's very feathery. Very tiny and feathery almost, the seed.
Yes, but it's got a peppery flavor.
Mm.
If you taste it, it's actually delicious. So I use that on top of the bread. So anyway, if you follow this recipe, you will get a big pillow-shaped loaf, like whole wheat bread in color. And, it's really quite good and nutritious.
Well, the photograph of it in the book is certainly does it justice. I have to say, the photographs in this little compendium of recipes are beautiful. And
Thank you. The
one of the Ezekiel bread, the bread looks delicious. So, but I was really surprised by the inclusion of the fava bean, the ground fava beans.
I guess that
was the one ingredient that really surprised me. Yeah. Lentils and millet, yes. I was not surprised by that, but the fava bean flour was one that more surprised me. But it's a beautiful.
Well, excuse me for interrupting.
That's
but
right.
What
no,
I was going
to
say is, you know, that the fava bean, the fresh fava bean, is one of the most eaten beans in the world, except in America. It's more popular than garbanzo, than lentils in the Mediterranean as a fresh bean, and then also as a pulse, as a dried bean, because we use it in Morocco in soups. So fava bean is a very common ingredient in the Mediterranean, but not so much in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I recommend it. So that's why in the book I give recipes for the dried beans, favas, and also it's in Ezekiel bread and it's in a soup, and then also for fresh fava beans. They're delicious, and the season is coming up. You know,
labor-intensive, but worth the work. Right?
Worth the work. I mean, it's a springtime vegetable, so
right.
If you see them, and I'm sure in your area the Italians use a lot of fava beans, so you can probably find it.
Oh, the green markets. The green markets are. They celebrate them whenever they first arrive on the market. Yes, it's very very well advertised. And as I say, worth the effort because it's a special springtime treat. You were talking a lot about the nigella seeds, and you talked about dukkha. Am I saying that right? The dukkha?
Yes.
Very common mix that's used. Can you talk about that briefly?
Okay. Dukkha, I did not call it that in my biblical feast book. I called it a sesame nigella dip. But actually, dukkha is the Arabic word because this mixture is very popular in Egypt. And I recreated the mixture with biblical ingredients using ground almonds, ground cumin, nigella seeds, and salt. And I tell you, I eat this. I have some in my kitchen at this moment. You grind the recipes. You just follow the instructions. You toast the almonds, grind the almonds, toast the cumin, grind the cumin, add Nigella, and add salt. And you have a fabulous dip. You dip the bread in olive oil and then in this sesame Nigella sprinkle, and it is absolutely delicious. You can serve it at a party, and people will flip.
Oh, sounds wonderful.
Guaranteed.
Sort of like the everything bagel topping.
Well, exactly. But, you know, the almonds and the cumin seed are very, very Mediterranean, especially the cumin.
Right.
It gives a pop to this mixture that is quite unusual. Well, but, again, it's a mixture that you can adapt with the seeds or the nuts that you have. You
right.
make your own.
Right. There, what I have to mention before we wrap up is that another. I guess one more thing that surprised me. I mean, in my research, I've come across a lot of these ingredients. We know, many of us know who study culinary history, know the background of the foods, but the tilapia as a fish that is ancient times, that surprised me.
St. Peter's fish. It's also known as St. Peter's fish.
St. Peter's, yeah.
Possibly, and for that I relied on a paper published by a fisherman who lives on the Sea of Galilee. And that's probably one of the most common seafood after sardines and anchovies mm-hmm. that, was eaten in biblical times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that is definitely a biblical,
food. And some of the foods that have really not changed a lot, and will have changed in form somewhat by being cultivated, are, of course, leeks and garlic, as you mentioned in the top of the show, and almonds and figs and olives and pomegranates.
Pomegranate.
And honey, of course.
Right. But wild honey.
Yes, wild honey.
Because they may not have had, maybe they had sugar cane, but they didn't refine the sugar. Maybe they chewed sugar cane, mm-hmm. as do kids all over the place. In Mexico, the kids chew sugar cane. Not so much in North Africa, but they didn't have refined sugar. So what they made were fruit honeys. And by that I mean they boiled down the juice of dates, figs, of pomegranates, that can be a little bit citric, it can be a bit sour,
mm-hmm.
but when you boil, and of grapes, of course, which is sweet, it's a grape molasses, it's delicious, I use it in cooking,
mm-hmm.
and so those were the sweetening agents that they used, and honey as well, honey, wild. Bee honey.
Well, a lot of information packed in one little book, I must say. And it has been a pleasure to hear you talk about it and your research. And we will post your website, kittymorse.com. You can learn more about the book and about Kitty's background and her travels in cooking. And I thank you so much for being with us today, Kitty.
Thank you so much, Linda.
All right, and thank you for tuning in. I'm Linda Palacio, and this has been A Taste of the Past. And I would like to thank our executive producer, Jack Inslee.